This Week. I'm Caroline Hyde. This podcast has some of our favourite interviews from the Daily Market Close Show that I co-anchor with Romain Bostic, Taylor Riggs and Joe Weisenthal. What'd you miss? It's the perfect way to kick off your weekend. This week, Facebook confronted yet another crisis as an increasing number of big-name brands, including Microsoft, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, Pepsi and Ford, joined a boycott of advertising on the platform over charges that the social media company has not done enough to quell hate speech and racial hate on its platforms. Friday, we learned that CEO Mark Zuckerberg and COO Sheryl Sandberg will meet with at least three civil rights groups leading the effort. That's the Anti-Defamation League, the NAACP, and Colour of Change. Earlier in the week, I got the reaction to this growing boycott from Nick Clegg, Facebook's Vice President for Global Affairs and Communications. Clegg is a former British politician who served as Deputy Prime Minister of the UK as leader of the Liberal Democrats. I started by asking him about recent policy changes Facebook has instituted to fight voter suppression and racism on the platform, and the reaction from the civil rights leaders that, well, it wasn't enough.
I think it's quite right that civil rights organisations should pressure us to always do better. I think that's totally fair. We have 3 billion people or thereabouts on our platform around the world. Thankfully, hate speech is only a tiny minority of the total amount of content on our platforms. Around 115 billion messages are sent on our platforms on an average day, and only a tiny fraction of that is hate speech. But because it's a tiny fraction, it might be harder to identify and remove. But we should, of course, always strive to do as well as we possibly can be. We've got a lot better over the years. So at the moment, we identify and then remove about 90% of the hate speech on our platform before anyone reports it to us. And that is a transformation compared to where it was even 2 or 3 years ago, when it was as low as 23%. And independent assessments, the European Union issued a report last week, for instance, have confirmed that the velocity and scale at which we assess and deal with hate speech when it's reported to us within a 24-hour period is significantly stronger, our performance, than Twitter and YouTube and others. But, of course, it is quite right that people should always demand that we should do more where we can, which is why we made further announcements last Friday to tighten up, for instance, our policies on what are called inflammatory ads. And we will continue, of course, to look at further measures that we can take.
Do you think you're held to a slightly different standard? You mentioned that, of course, the EU feels that you're taking things down at a faster velocity than Twitter, than YouTube, but are you held to a different standard? Are you singled out unfairly?
Oh, no, I don't. I think with success comes responsibility, and with success comes accountability. And I think it's right that Facebook, given that though it's a private company, in many ways we provide the platform on which so much societal and public debate and political debate now plays out. And of course that is especially true in the highly polarized and fraught environment in which a lot of these debates are now playing out in the United States in an election year. And of course we're acutely aware that this is a time of great sensitivity. Emotions are running very, very high, rightly, in the United States after the killing of George Floyd. And of course, we are constantly scouring our platforms to make sure that there is legitimate public debate. Yes, that people say things that maybe others don't want to hear, but we believe in free expression, but we do that within certain limits. Mm. And we have clear policies, and we seek to make sure that those limits are properly safeguarded. But I know I'm certainly not complaining that there should be a particular focus on Facebook, because we do play a particularly important role in those public debates. The only thing I want to sort of point out fairly enough is that we're never going to eliminate all hate speech. Hateful individuals saying hateful things to each other has been around since the dawn of time, and every form of communication technology, email, yeah, telephone, now social media, are used by a minority of people to utter a minority of hateful things. It is our job to go after that content, but I don't want anyone to imagine that we can rid the world of hateful speech, because that is part of the human condition.
Yeah.
Our job is to make sure it's minimized as much as we can minimize it, but I don't want to pretend that we can eliminate it altogether. together.
What about the criticism that some feel that this content, particularly inflammatory content, glorifying violence, division, disinformation, in some way leads to more eyeballs and therefore in some way leads to a bigger bottom line, greater revenue for Facebook? Is there a worry, and how do you tackle that criticism that you're not doing enough because basically it helps generate revenue for you?
Oh, let me be absolutely clear. We do not profit from hate. We have no incentive to have hate on our platform. We don't like it. Crucially, our users don't like it. Users, we know this from the surveys that we conduct with users, they don't like to see hateful, inflammatory content on their news feed. And of course, advertisers, they've made quite clear, don't like it either. It's not a question of whether one is for or against hate. Everybody is against hate. Mm. It is, what do you do about it? We do not benefit from hate. We benefit from positive human connection. And thankfully, the vast majority of content on Facebook is positive, useful, sometimes playful, often innocent. It's families sharing photos and videos of their own, of their family birthday parties. It's the dad creating a Facebook group for his daughter's football team. It's the local family business reaching out to customers by way of our platforms. That is what we want to celebrate and safeguard while bearing down on the minority, the small minority of hateful content that we want to get rid of just as much as anybody else.
And you've been, of course, talking with civil rights leaders. You've been working with them for a long time. For example, Laura Murphy, the civil rights audit that you do each year. If it's not about the bottom line, which you so eloquently put, why take the decisions now to start changing policy when much of your work with the civil rights community has been going on for months, as you already say? Why make the change now?
Well, in part because this is ongoing work. The work with Laura Murphy and the independent civil rights audit that's being conducted into our policies and our practices is an iterative process. And they've already issued a number of reports and will be issuing a final audit in the weeks to come. But, for instance, after the legitimate debate about the different decisions that different social media companies took about some of the tweets and posts from President Trump recently, Mark Zuckerberg said that quite openly that we will continue to review policies, for instance, about when and when not to justify posts and content about state action and the use of state force. What more should we be doing to safeguard the elections, to make sure that voter registration and voter information is as available and authoritative as it can be to millions of American voters? We are launching, for that reason, the country's, America's largest voter information and voter registration effort ever. And we announced on Friday that going forward, we haven't put it into practice yet, almost any post dealing with how to vote, the voting process, particularly whether the voting process will be affected by the COVID pandemic, will have a link attached to it. So a user could just click on that link and immediately be referred to authoritative, useful information about how, where, and when to vote. Those are the steps we're taking. It's an ongoing journey. We will continue to make improvements.
Of course, talking about voting, and I know you're a man who served in British politics for a long time, you know about stress and on the day job, but how are you coping and how are the employees at Facebook coping?
I think everybody at Facebook accepts and embraces the fact that Facebook, because of its success, because people enjoy using our products, you enjoy using Instagram, Facebook, Messenger, WhatsApp at the scale that they do, that scale and that success comes with particular responsibilities. And we work exceptionally hard. We believe that we have an industry-leading record in how we deal with the dark side of the internet, as well as all the joy and the light and the good side of the internet. We accept that that journey is never finished, that job is never done. We constantly need to evolve. We have developed now some of the world's most sophisticated machine learning and AI systems so that we can go after this bad content at great speed and at great scale. But I think everybody accepts that that is a legitimate source of wider public debate and that people quite rightly will want to put pressure on us to go further and faster. It's equally, however, our job and my job in this interview to explain what we've achieved, how our values aligned with those people who want to rid the platform of hate speech, and the reality of how we go about doing that. Because I don't want to pretend that this is an easy, straightforward task. It was simply a switch we can flick and then all hate speech suddenly disappears from one instant to the next. That, unfortunately, is not a solution which is available to us.
This week, Joe spoke with Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who also writes a column for the New York Times and serves as a distinguished professor of economics in the PhD program at City University of New York, ahead of Jobs Day to talk about recent resurgence of COVID infections and how government programs to fight the subsequent economic downturn have played out in practice. Joe started by asking Krugman if the US economy is on track to recover.
No, I think we're in big trouble. I mean, back about a month and a half ago, I was laying out the bad scenario, because it was fairly clear that we were going to have a couple of good months of recovery because there was a lot of pent-up demand for stuff that people weren't being allowed to do, and you were opening it up. The bad scenario was that we would have a spike in COVID-19 cases that would lead us to have to stall and backtrack, and that's happening. I mean, so we're gonna get a jobs report on Thursday, which is tomorrow, I guess, which is going to look good, but it's going to be in the rearview mirror, and it's going to be a dead cat bounce. And it's clear that the high frequency data and everything we're seeing says that we just hit a wall because of the spiking cases in the Sun Belt.
Let's stipulate for a second that in order to get a durable recovery, we do need to get the virus under control or at some point, hopefully a very effective therapy or vaccine. So setting that aside, from an economic policy standpoint at this point, and we know that in Congress, they're going to revisit this question at some point in early July. What would you say are the key priorities for what we need from an economic policy standpoint?
Okay. I mean, I've been of the view that this is not like aftermath of the financial crisis when you had a wounded economy or an economy that had gotten over its skis before the crisis. And so it took years to get out of it and you needed a lot of stimulus along the way. I don't think that's happening now. I think that you know my politics, but even so, I have to say that I don't think the economy as of February was fundamentally unbalanced. So if the virus were under control, I think we could, I think there's a lot of good reason to believe that we could have a very fast recovery and wouldn't need all that much in the way of policy. The problem is that appears to be a number of months off. And where we are right now is that we are back in the situation we were in March, April, of an economy that is in a coma because of the virus. And so the goal of policy is to make that situation tolerable, to avoid having the depression spread any further than it has to, and to make a partially locked down economy livable, which means that we need to continue a lot of the programs that we put in place in March. And the big concern is, of course, a lot of that stuff is going to expire in a few weeks.
Are you surprised, arguably, by the effectiveness of the programs? I mean, we see household incomes actually up between April and May relative to their March levels, despite the extraordinary collapse in unemployment. Obviously, you can't look too much at the stock market, but it looks like demand is reasonably buoyant for some consumer companies, not something that you would expect to see during a period of mass unemployment. Have you been surprised by the effectiveness of what they passed?
Yeah, I mean, it was. First of all, I was surprised by what they passed. I mean, that was the CARES Act was highly imperfect, but by U.S. standards, by the standards of how we dealt with previous downturns, it was actually damn good. We actually, in particular, the unemployment benefits were a huge lifeline. Perhaps most of the unemployed actually ended up with more income, which in turn contained the spillover. So we shut down part of the economy. And one of the great concerns was that shutting that down would, by depleting people's incomes, lead to a secondary round of unemployment in the rest of the economy. But we provided so much aid that didn't happen. So, no, I have to say, on the whole, the paycheck protection appears to have been a lot less effective than it should have been. And other parts of it the money, the large business lending basically didn't happen. So there, it's a mixed picture. But if we should grade it on, I grade it on a curve compared to what you might have expected, given the U.S. record, we did extraordinarily well.
Do you worry that if the sort of simple virus containment phase of this crisis is prolonged, that we will get that secondary round of layoffs? Companies looking at their general structure, their headcount, and saying, this is not going to make sense in a period in which actual business activity is so diminished?
Yeah, there's some of that. And there's also the point right now, most immediately before that, is that the unemployment, the extra unemployment benefits expire at the end of this month, but actually for most workers will be cut off on the 25th because of the way the program works. Paycheck protection is pretty much shot as wad. State and local, we just had New York City, and that was huge cuts in spending. So state and local government, that's going to start to affect the economy in a major way. So I think we're looking at, even before, I mean, there's a question about businesses deciding that they can't sustain what they've been doing, but there's also going to be a very real collapse in demand next month unless we have a major legislation, which does not appear to be in the pipeline right now.
One of the thoughts when it comes to legislation, both in terms of the next phase of this stimulus, but also an increasingly loud, an idea that's getting more attention, particularly on the left side of the spectrum, is this idea of automatic stabilizers. Why do we need to have a big vote to expand unemployment insurance every time there's a downturn, as opposed to just something automatic? Do you think that that should be something that's part of our policy arsenal always?
Yes, very much so.
Expansion that kicks in?
Yeah, I mean, we always had a little bit of that in unemployment benefits. There was some aspects of the federal unemployment insurance program were tied to the state of the economy, but not nearly enough. And what we've learned, there's one thing I think we've learned over the past dozen years, is that the U.S. does fiscal policy in response to events very badly. Everything gets caught up in partisan gridlock, and everything becomes a huge mess. But automatic stabilizers work pretty well, and if we can agree into law in advance that these are the things, unemployment benefits will expand, some maybe state and local government aid should be on an automatic stabilizer as well. Yes, definitely, it would. Just mean that the next time we hit something bad, we'll do less arguing and more dealing with it.
Do you think it's possible that in the wake of this crisis, governments around the world, and I'm thinking, for example, of Germany, which seems to be taking a more, arguably more progressive view of fiscal policy than it has in the past, the role that it can play in recovery, that aggressive, robust fiscal policy could become a more permanent feature of the economic landscape, relying a little bit less on monetary policy for recovery and stabilization?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen, the actual story here is the dog that didn't bark. We have a huge expansion of deficits, huge spending by everybody. And first of all, the bond markets have not shown any sign of concern. And secondly, the political system has been remarkably unconcerned. All of those people who were screaming about deficits and debt in 2010 are remarkably quiet now, because the need is so obvious and the willingness of the markets to accept major increases in government debt is so obvious. So I think we have possibly turned a corner on that. I think even, Germany is an interesting case, because Germany is fiscally, they have a history of being extremely spendthrift on deficits, but they also have a lot of social solidarity, and so confronted with a humanitarian emergency that required big deficits, the Germans sort of said, "Well, okay," and the sky hasn't fallen, and I think that's actually an important sign. I think in some ways Europe is learning a bigger lesson than we are, though I think we are learning a lesson as well.
Before we go, I want to just ask one more question. You mentioned the budget cuts, the state and local. Yeah. That's going to be a drag on economic growth. the Fed has implemented a fairly rare program to directly lend against future tax revenues to cities and states. Should it get more aggressive on that and really look at ways to ease the burden further on municipalities so that they don't have to cut jobs, pushing the Fed farther away from its
delivery? Yeah, they should. I mean, if the Fed is going to be is willing to buy non-investment grade bonds, which it is, then for sure it should be willing to buy munis. The trouble is that the main constraints on deficit spending at state and local are not that the markets won't accept their debt. It's that they have rules often embodied in their constitutions that prevent them from doing that. So there's only so much the Fed can do, but to the extent that they can find ways around it, should the Fed be out there helping lubricate the system? Yeah, I mean, it's, if anything, a more worthy cause than stabilizing corporate bonds.
This week, I also put CEO Spotlight on Dow's chief executive, Jim Fitterling. He joined me for a wide-ranging interview to discuss how Dow is faring amid the pandemic, his pledge to make the company carbon neutral by 2050, and how coming out to his workforce and serving as one of the few openly gay CEOs in corporate America has informed his commitment to diversity and inclusion as a pillar of Dow's mission. I started by asking Fitterling about how he sees his path ahead, navigating a global company in such a tumultuous time.
This has been an unbelievable time. I think I joked with you. We try to keep our sense of humor here. We sent around the kind of the back to the future picture where the professor tells Michael J. Fox, whatever you do, don't set it on 2020. But it's been an interesting year. You know, demand, as we thought going into second quarter, because of all the lockdowns that were happening around the world, demand in April and May was pretty slow. And we took some actions to slow down some of our operating rates just because we're trying to manage cash and liquidity, and we didn't want to end up building a lot of inventory during this time. We didn't have very good visibility to what the recovery was going to be like. We're starting to see things started to open up in late May. We're seeing more things open up in June. And I would say if you looked at things like going into the pandemic where there were a lot of panic buying, consumer goods, packaging, health and hygiene materials, items that you would use for sanitization, those were all very strong. But then the big economy, like any capital spending, any construction, any automotive part of the economy was very, appliances, furniture was very, very slow. And what we've seen is some of the panic buying has come off through the quarter, but the demands are still good for packaging and home care and health and cleaning and hygiene. And we're starting to see a automotive pick back up. So we saw good, in the month of May, we saw good sales increases. You know, automotive sales in May were quite a bit below the prior year. In June, they've jumped up quite a bit. A lot of that's coming out of inventory. The automotive startups are coming, but we really need the production ramp up before we see the chemicals demand come with it. And then I think the other area that's just had an overall effect on things like travel, going to sporting events, any outside activities, has been the stay-at-home orders. So when that happens, things on some of the high end of our business, like products that go into beauty and personal care, cosmetics, those kinds of things have decreased and haven't come back yet. Oil took a big dip down at the beginning of the quarter, mainly because of the supply-demand imbalance. And then the moves in OPEC and the shutdown of the number of wells here on the shale fields in the U.S. have started to tighten that up. So we've seen oil kind of move off of the $20 numbers back up into the $40 a barrel range. And our outlook is I would say more bullish now than bearish on oil, but it's going to take a while for the big demand to kick in to bring oil back. So right now, you know, in the month of June, we see almost every value chain in our portfolio showing better sales than May. In April and May, we couldn't say that. But it's a gradual return, and we're keeping an eye on it, and we're going to continue to do the things that we need to do to manage cash and liquidity during this time.
How have you really learned and experienced from seeing this so early on in your business in China and then China picking back up? What do you think the playbook will be for America, for Latin America, where you find exposure as well? How on earth do you navigate that geographical perspective as well?
Well, in China, when this happened and the lockdowns happened, we saw things like automotive sales drop like 90%. And when they came back, they made a pretty sharp comeback once people could get into dealerships and they could go buy a car. We saw construction slow, and it had been slow for a while. And we've seen that come back. We saw a big shift in retail to digital. So the digital retail channels did really well, just like we've seen here in the United States. And we saw similar moves in people, you know, taking out orders and staying at home from restaurants and things, and restaurants not being open. So I think that kind of gave us a picture to what was going to happen. Now, when China came back, I would say there was a pretty sharp increase back to, say, 80% of pre-COVID levels. And then it kind of stabilized because as the manufacturing picked up, the consumer demand came back, but it didn't come back to pre-COVID levels. It came back short of that. So I think what it showed us is we were going to see some bounce back and some pent-up demand, but then you're going to start to see a more gradual return to pre-COVID levels. And right now, I think everybody's trying to titrate how long they think it will take to get back to pre-COVID levels. I think on the consumer side, the consumer disposable side, the staples, it'll be faster. On the bigger ticket items, bigger spend items, it's going to take a little bit longer.
How much worry do you have that perhaps countries are coming back too quickly? The second wave is something we talk of ad nauseum. Is it something that you're really palpably concerned about?
You have to be concerned about it from the health and safety of the workforce. I mean, so the actions that we took at the beginning of the pandemic were to keep people safe because it, whatever business you're in, it all relies on people to keep rolling. Mm-hmm. And so we have about 36,500 employees. Right through the pandemic, we had 14,000 that reported into work every day. And we work in an environment where we're used to PPE, we're used to operating discipline, safe behaviors and practices. It's the nature of the kind of work that we do in manufacturing. And so we moved into that space and we said, here are the things that we need to do. And it's worked remarkably well. I worry on a second wave, what I worry about is that the general population, if they don't follow the playbook, you know, wear a face covering. It seemed to have gotten very controversial here about wearing a face covering, but it's a very simple concept. If you cover your face, your nose and your mouth, you're protecting somebody else from anything that you aerosolize in the environment. And likewise, if they do that, they're protecting you from them. That's what doctors and nurses do when you go in to see them. It's a very common practice. And one of the things we know scientifically is one of the receptors that is the biggest for the disease is your nose. So if you keep your nose and mouth covered, you're mitigating your risk. And you're not completely eliminating the risk. I mean, the virus is still there. You can still get it. But we're trying to mitigate the risk. And I think if the public, you know, gets itself too lax and they think, well, heat and sunlight is going to kill it. And then they say, I don't need to wear this mask, or I don't need to social distance, or I don't need to do these other things like wash my hands or sanitize. Then suddenly you see the cases go back up. And so the virus hasn't gone away, but we've reopened the economies. And as we go back in, if we don't have some discipline, we're going to see cases rise. And when cases start to rise, a few weeks later, deaths start to rise. So that's the concern. My concern is, you know, keeping people healthy to keep things operational. I think the bigger concern is you don't want to see economies shut down again, because we saw that impact in April, May, and that was tough. And once you get it going again, you'd like to keep it going. So, you know, what we try to implore everybody at work to do is follow these practices, not just at home, but follow at work, but follow them at home too. It's your best way to stay safe. And by the way, it protects everybody else.
And has that been a different message from country to country, employee to employee? We talked before about how you keep one culture at Dow, where you can walk into a plant that you might have based in Asia and it'll feel in some way similar to the one that you have in the United States. How have you managed that with so many people working from home, but also so many different geographical and global perspectives on the reaction to this pandemic?
Well, I like to think that because we're a science and technology company, that we take that view of it. So I do think within the Dow facilities, you'll see common practices. I would say culturally, we see differences. So in Asia, because they've had the experiences of SARS and MERS and other pandemic diseases before, there's a natural tendency that when something like this happens, they'll put on a face covering. And so there hasn't been an issue culturally with getting people to, you know, adapt to that. Now, in some places, you know, there's been a lack of somebody saying this is the right thing to do, or there's been mixed messages. And I think what that's led to is we're starting to see cases spike back up. And then when they spike back up, everybody says, well, we've got to go to face coverings now. I'll just give you an anecdotal data point. We haven't had a case in Asia Pacific. We've had them in Europe, and we've had them here, and we've had them in Latin America, but we haven't had a case in Asia.
Wow.
I think you've got to say there's a little bit cultural there that has an impact. And I know we're a small population of the world, but we're kind of a microcosm of society. So I think that says a lot.
Talk to us about how you get the perspective, being so global, being the footprint that you have in Asia, also of not only the pandemic that you're trying to deal with, but ongoing tensions that many international business currently faces. We have not only a spike in cases of a global pandemic, but we have a spike in concerns about global trade tensions, for example, the relationship between the US and China, between the US and the EU. How do you navigate that right now?
Well, I think we had those tensions before the pandemic. And so we were taking a look at a world that was, you know, where global trade was being challenged. Fortunately for Dow, we've got a footprint around the world that has manufacturing in about 30 countries. And, you know, if we can be low-cost producer and be in a country, that's the most ideal thing to do. But a certain amount of our business is based on export. And so as the export channels slow down because of trade relations or because of COVID, you've got to make adjustments and you've got to shift, you know, so we've got to shift, you know, moving product from maybe the United States to China and focus more on Europe or Middle East to service those markets. So we can make those shifts happen. I think in our business, we're not at the heart of some of the toughest controversial issues around national security. But there is a large amount of trade between the U.S. and China on petrochemicals, so obviously we get used as leverage a little bit. So we've made that shift happen. I think we'll be able to navigate through those things. I think as we get through the pandemic, we'll be able to navigate through that. And more we have to look at what are we doing for the local market. So, you know, investments in North America for North America and Latin America, investments in China for China is part of the strategy that we have to look at going forward.
And how about the oil market that you so mentioned, the fact that you're feeling a little bit more bullish there? It's going to take a while, of course, to break back above the $40 mark. But how do you see the oil market from a global perspective? Has shale lost its edge? Does that have ramifications from a U.S. perspective, being a U.S.-based business?
The cost curve is flattened. I mean, with oil coming down as much as it has, the cost curve is flattened between people who use oil-based feedstocks and natural gas liquids. But ethane, U.S.-based ethane, is still advantaged. It's still the most advantaged. It doesn't have the spread difference that it used to have. And oil, more than anything, our products are related to oil. So oil plays a factor in what the selling price of the products are. And so we watch that spread. The other thing that happens, though, is that as oil comes down and that oil to ethane ratio narrows, or the naphtha to ethane ratio narrows, it also backs up a certain amount of ethane exports out of the U.S., so that makes more feedstocks available here. So it's not intuitive to people that that's what happens, but that happens, and it doesn't really make us uncompetitive. It just makes some other regions more competitive. So how we see that is in a case where oil gets lower, our European assets become more competitive. Mm. Our Asian joint venture in Thailand becomes more competitive. Our Middle East and US-based and Canadian assets are still competitive, but just maybe not as competitive as they were before. So having geographic diversification as well as having feedstock flexibility helps us out. And in Asia, you know, a couple of years ago when natural gas was so much cheaper than oil, we were cracking a lot of LPGs in Europe. Now we're cracking more naphtha in Europe because the prices have changed. So using that feedstock flexibility to our advantage is big.
Given that, it feels as though you really benefit from having the global perspective, being able to see best practice in Asia, being able to bring that home to the US, apply it in Europe. And when we're seeing that, not only from your oil market exposure, but from a COVID exposure, are you now being looked at in any way for a return to work expertise almost? You're saying that a bulk of your workers, some 14,000 or so, have remained in the plant throughout because a lot of what you produce is essential right now, particularly when we're talking of PPE gear and plastics. What are you looking at in terms of returning people to work, and how do you make sure that that is people before profit to a certain extent?
In a way, we raised our hand at the beginning because we knew that the economy couldn't stay shut down forever. And we also knew that we were able, as an essential industry, we were able to work through the pandemic and do it safely. So we had a good track on the number of cases that we had. So in places where we have manufacturing, we would raise our hand to be part of groups that were working on reopening the economy. I was part of a Michigan Economic Recovery Council here. One of our leaders in Louisiana has been part of the governor's council there on how to reopen the economy. And what we did was we just put together a playbook, which we made available online on Dow.com. Anybody can download it. It's a PDF, and it has all of our safe work practices, whether it's in the plant or in the office. It covers everything from screening, the questions that we ask somebody when they come into work every day, temperature screening, how we manage social distancing in the plant, how we manage PPE like face coverings. You know, minimum when you come in is we want you to wear a face covering. You may work in a job where it requires a more sophisticated type of PPE, so you know that may change things. And then it addresses issues like no big group meetings. If you're going to go to one of the food service outlets or cafeteria, you know, you're not going to see a buffet or anything. You're going to see a prepackaged meal that you can pick up and take away. We're not encouraging, you know, people to be in close quarters across from each other. And you know, we do big maintenance projects from time to time. We'll have a plant turnaround that might be going on. So in those cases, we might have hundreds or 1,000 workers on site doing a plant turnaround. So how do you manage them when it's time for lunch break for that many people? You know, we've been able to put together eating facilities and meeting facilities where they can space and they can have dividers and screens, and so they're protected from each other. We also geared up to do a lot of contact tracing. We don't test everybody every day when they come in. There just isn't enough testing to do that. And we didn't want to compete with the local communities for testing. So what we did is we would work with a local hospital, or in some larger sites, we'd have our own capability to do it at a Dow Medical Clinic. And if somebody's symptomatic or they've got a fever or they've come into contact with somebody with COVID, we're going to get them tested. And if we find out through contact tracing that somebody is really at risk for having come into contact, we're going to ask them to get tested and also ask them to self-quarantine. If we ask somebody to stay home because we want them to self-quarantine, we still pay them while they're at home. We don't penalize them for that. But that's because we want people to follow the precautions and we want to protect the plant environment that's there. And it's worked. And so we've shared that with governments and we shared what we do with other industries on the Michigan Council. We had every industry represented from healthcare, automotive, chemical manufacturing, restaurants, hoteliers, you name it. And we looked at all of them. And in that case, we put together all of our best practices for each one. And it's been really instructive, I think, for the governors in terms of, you know, you can go back to work, but you have to take precautions and you have to be safe.
Have there been some governments more than others that are easier to work with, or that you've been impressed with the way in which they've dealt with the pandemic and you've been able to work much more easily alongside them in terms of testing, for example?
I'd say they're all working well with us. They're all open to suggestions and ideas. Some have had more success than others. You know, in general, the places that really got a serious, you know, what I would say, foothold on this thing early on, have had the best results. So they really flattened the curve early and then gradually reopened, have shown better results so far. And because of the rate of this, the transmissibility of this disease, the rate of doubling can be so fast. If you don't get on it early, you can overwhelm the hospitals and you don't have enough hospital beds and ICU beds. And so what I encourage people to do is, you know, not get too hung up on the percentages, because the percentages make it seem like it's a trivial disease. If you get this disease and you have to get on a ventilator, you're not going to be on there very many days before you have to have a tracheotomy, and your life after this is going to be quite a bit different. So you need to take it seriously.
Do you worry America isn't taking it seriously enough?
In some places, I do. I think people have to make their own individual choices. You have to keep your social distancing. And if you're going out and you're looking at an environment, you're saying, this is crazy, this is risky. I'm really increasing my chance of getting this disease. You have to kind of take a step back and protect yourself.
Have you been able to protect yourself? It must be so hard as someone who I know likes to travel, to be in the plants, to be with your people. How hard is it not being able to do that?
It's tough, but it seems like I'm doing this every day for 8 or 10 hours a day, right? We're still connected. In some ways, we're more connected than we were before. And I do think the one thing that it's done is it's really caused us to focus in on the things that are critically important and not so much on the things that were nice to do things. You know, this is kind of a big reset right now. So it forces you to reprioritize and say, okay, in this environment, these are the things that absolutely have to be done. And these are the things that can wait a little bit.
How have you seen COVID change the way in which your business is balanced? We talked about how your employees now go in and get not a buffet, but a packaged food type. Do you think that that's here to stay, particularly when we've had such a pushback from across the world against single-use plastics, for example, and now suddenly they seem almost necessary and integral for some?
Well, our plastics demand for packaging is probably going to be up year over year, and for PPE and some of those applications. I think some of that won't change. I mean, packaging has always been about food safety and security, health and hygiene. That's been a big driver. I do think some behavioral changes are here to stay. I'm not sure, you know, on the plant-based level and serving meals and things, I think that'll probably stay that way until we get a vaccine and until we get a treatment and we can move into a different phase of this. But if you just looked at places like the grocery store, there's been a lot of information out there lately. Consumer behavior has changed, and some of the retailers and the grocery store owners would say it's probably changed in some cases dynamically, where people might used to go to 3 or 4 grocery stores to do their shopping. They've maybe consolidated that down to one, and maybe they've focused on the one that will do curbside pickup or contactless pickup. So some of those things I think probably have changed. Online sales have changed in the retail sector. We've seen that a lot. We've seen the amount of online interaction with customers change. their use of Dow.com to find information has been there. We had been investing a lot in digital to help them be able to see shipments, be able to see, you know, what was coming for their orders and to plan a little bit better. That has paid off big time through this whole thing.
How does this reorientation and focus on, particularly we see now PPE gear, very sadly, floating in the oceans. It's keeping us safe, but it's not keeping our environment safe. And I know that you're a man who very much talks about how you want to be one of the most sustainable material science companies out there. You've just put out a sustainability report. How has COVID changed the focus of plastics in particular and the push for more environmentally friendly offerings?
Well, we can't, a circular economy just isn't going to happen. We have to create a circular economy. And so the economy that we have today, unfortunately, whether you're using plastics or you're using glass or other materials, you use it and you throw it away and not enough of it gets recycled. And even for the products that people think they're recycling, not enough of that gets recycled, paperboard and other things. So what you have to do is you have to close the loop on that. And when we announced, you know, some of our new sustainability goals, the two on plastics that we're focused on is stopping the waste and closing the loop. And closing the loop is going to require us to work with governments on collection and being able to close the loop and get the recycle back in. It has to be done in an affordable way because you're competing with the virgin feedstocks to make plastics and they're cheaper. So, you know, the economy is doing what is the most efficient and cheapest right now to make plastics. But if you want to close the loop, and we do, there are ways to make that happen. Enhanced producer schemes, responsibility schemes that would drive closing the circular economy, that would create an economic incentive to recycle the material. I've talked before about like beverage bottles, the reverse vending machines in stores where you pay a deposit when you buy the bottle, you get the deposit back when you bring it back. Well, that creates a recycled stream of material that goes back into the economy and it goes back into bottles again. We can do that with a lot of single-use plastic so it doesn't go to the oceans. And we've stopped a lot of things in Europe, in North America, China. We've stopped a lot of shipping of waste, especially shipping it to countries like Southeast Asia, which don't have the infrastructure to deal with their own waste already, much less that from the developed world. We stopped that, but now we've got to build the infrastructure to close that loop. Brand owners are stepping up. They're saying we will buy more post-consumer recycle material in our packages, which is good. Now we've got to get the post-consumer recycle material to them. We just had an announcement recently with a partner down in Houston, Avangard Innovative, who makes material for us, and it's post-consumer recycle material that we blend in with other materials to sell to our brand owners so that they can have a circular product. So we made a commitment and we said, if we can take 1 million metric tons a year of plastics back into the circular economy, and we put that out there because if everybody stepped up and did that, we would create a huge demand for post-consumer recycle material. Now we've got to work on the economic business model to make that work. And one of the things that we get into is people, a lot of times people just say, well, we'll just tax the carbon on the plastics. The problem with the taxes is they don't go towards solving the problem. The taxes just go into the general coffers and they don't get spent to create the circular economy. You need something like an enhanced producer responsibility scheme that creates that circular economy and closes that loop and brings that plastic back in so that we can reuse it. And the second thing we're doing is making sure that everything we make has the potential to be fully recyclable or reusable. And that is something that immediately brand owners can take advantage of and take out to the public, because that is something that the public wants as well.
Public wants it. You've put out an ambitious goal to be carbon neutral by 2050. Just how hard is that, not just from working with brands, making things recyclable, reusable, but also your entire supply chain? Are you working with the oil companies that you so depend upon to ensure that you can put in place a supply chain that is entirely carbon neutral as well. How hard is it?
It's tough because you also need to grow your business to keep up with demand. So you want to become carbon neutral and still grow your business to keep up with population growth, middle class growth, and demand growth. In our business, our CO2 footprint largely comes from combustion of natural gas to drive furnaces that make the products that make plastics. Isn't the plastics themselves, but it's the process to make them that creates it. And so we're using the most efficient technology today to do that. But if we want to get carbon neutral by 2050, we've got to look at other things. So we've got process technology activity and research going on to try to reduce the CO2 emissions of that process by as much as 20 to 40%. We've got technology we're looking at together with Shell on electric cracking and whether that makes sense. And if we can do that, we're going to pilot that in Europe. If that works, we might be able to electrify some of those crackers. Now, if you do that, the electricity needs to come from a process that doesn't combust gas, because at the end of the day, that electricity is going to be less efficient than direct firing with gas. So we're looking at all of that. We have good experience on being able, through normal efficiency and use of existing technology, from 2006 to last year, we reduced our footprint by 15%. So by 2030, we're going to try to reduce our footprint by another 15%. I think we've got a good line on how to do that. To 2050, to get to carbon neutral, we're going to have to take some bigger steps, some of our own process technology innovations, maybe electric cracking. Certainly, we have to look at carbon capture. Carbon capture, I think, is going to have to be part of the answer, because one of the most efficient ways to get energy today is to combust natural gas. And if you don't combust natural gas, and if you don't have nuclear as an option, if you need dispatchable power, you're going to be forced to look at something like coal, which is moving the wrong direction. The other thing we're doing is alternative energy. And so we've got a layer now of alternative energy. It's getting close to our target for 2025 with 750 megawatts. We're more than two-thirds of the way there, and we'll probably beat that target. But alternative energy can't replace all of the energy that we use. This layer of alternative energy that's coming in on wind and solar is cheap.
Yeah.
But if I were to try to replace everything that we use as a company, it doesn't have the reliability. These power sources can drop out of the grid for hours or days, and I run 24/7 continuous operations that can't drop out for a millisecond. So you have to have a different kind of reliability. So I can do some with alternative energy, but then we've got to come up with some bigger solutions. Supply chain is part of it. We have just as much of a footprint on the supply chain, if not more, than we do from our direct manufacturing. So we'll look at all the scopes. And we also have to remember that our products offer benefits to society. We make insulation materials that make energy efficient buildings. Buildings consume 40 to 50% of the energy in the world. So if we can make them more energy efficient, we're doing a service to society, and we're helping bring down the overall CO2 footprint. So we have to take that into account as well.
Talking about service to society, talking about aims to be a sustainable materials science company, but also an inclusive one. And Jim, you're someone who has made such moves in and of yourself in 2014, yourself coming out to your own working employee base, a man who is one of the only openly gay chief executives in America. I want to ask you about the consuming nature of the fight for equality that we see in America right now, whether it be in terms of race, but also in terms of sexuality, religion, age, gender, you name it. How are you looking to talk to your employee base about this at the moment and drive for change?
And we just had an employee webcast this morning on that. And really, we start from a standpoint of core values. Dow's core values are respect for people, our integrity, and protecting the planet. And to me, inclusion and diversity is all about human decency and the contribution that we make to society. So it's how we treat each other. and the golden rule, you know, you treat each other the way you want to be treated. And it's an interesting time that we're going through this pandemic. We're dealing with climate change and sustainability, and we're dealing with equality and racial injustice at the same time, because I think they all show us just how interconnected the world is and how small it really is and how much of an impact that we all have on each other. You know, how one virus can affect everybody around the world, how climate change can affect everybody around the world, and racial injustice, when it started as a U.S. thing with George Floyd's murder, you look at that now and you say, well, it has raised the attention all around the world, not just in the United States. Look, our focus on, when I got named a CEO and we were spinning out the company, we had to come up with a purpose statement or an ambition statement for the company. Material science company focuses on chemistry and physics and engineering. That's how we solve problems. But when I looked at it, I said, I think there are four pillars that are going to be important for us to be the best in this space. We have to be the most innovative. We have to be the one that's closest to our customers and listening to our customers about what they want from a standpoint of new product and sustainability. We have to be inclusive and we have to be sustainable. And some people ask, well, why'd you put inclusive in there? I think it speaks to collaboration and I think it speaks to how you work. And it also speaks to you're a reflection of the society around you. In terms of numbers of employees, we're small. In terms of the industries we're touch, we're big. Mm. So we are an example for our little local communities that we serve, and we're an example for the bigger world. And we need to take that seriously, and we need to be a good role model in how to do that. And if we're not dealing with racial equality and equity and social justice inside our own company, if we're not dealing with LGBT issues inside our own company or gender diversity, then we're really not doing the right thing for our employee population. At the end of the day, when you want to be innovative, you want people focused on the job at hand. And when they come into work, you want them being able to bring themselves, not worry about anything that's going on outside, and focus on their work. If they're coming from a background where they feel like every day, the minute they leave your workplace, they're under scrutiny. The minute they get in their car, the first thing they think about is, I'm going to get pulled over by a policeman somewhere for no apparent reason. All these things pile up on them, and physically and mentally, it takes a toll. And, you know, I elected to stay in the closet for a long time in my career, but I can tell you after coming out that physically and mentally, it takes a toll if you do that every day. And what we're trying to do is eliminate that for people and lift people up. If you've got an economy or a world and 80% of the people are doing well and 20% of them are oppressed, and you said to yourself, what would that economy look like if everybody was doing well and you didn't have that oppression? I don't think you have to do much math to get to the point that that would be a better economy. And so for what we can do, we need to be a role model to treat people the right way at work. And if we can also bring that into the communities that we serve, then I think we can have a powerful multiplier effect to do that. And that's as simple as it gets. We're not trying to take political sides on this thing. We're just trying to treat people the right way.
Can you give us an example, just to finish, of what you've done to listen or to change or to push for inclusivity when other businesses look to you to help give guidance?
Well, last week we put together a set of commitments called DAO ACT. ACT is an acronym for advocacy, community, and talent. And we put some financial commitment behind it. I would say it's not just a money thing, and the amount of money isn't going to solve the issue alone. But internally on advocacy, we've made sure that we've got a social justice council internally to deal with issues of inequality inside of DAO. And then externally, we're focused on policy. So what can we do? We have community advisory panels in each of the communities that we work with. we can work in those panels to focus on policies about engaging and leading alliances and changes to get equality for African Americans in the United States. We've looked at advocacy with organizations like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Equal Justice Initiative to help move that. On community, we've been doing a lot of work on supplier diversity. We need to make sure that we don't have any barriers in place that would keep a minority-owned business from doing business with us. On talent, and it all comes down to people at the end of the day, really focusing on the diversity of our pipeline, but also in our industry, we've had a lot of focus on historically Black colleges and universities, so upping our commitment to them, and through our community college skilled trades programs, which creates opportunities for employment and advancement for African Americans, but for all races as well. And internally, we're going to be working with our people leaders on really requiring racial equity and advanced inclusion training. I'm not talking about unconscious bias training. I'm talking about more than that. I'm talking about really understanding how to spot it and how to deal with it, and what are the microaggressions that everybody feel every day, and how to change the environment in that way.
That's it for this episode of What You Missed This Week. If you like the podcast, make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And tune in every weekday to our daily market close show from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg Television and from 4 to 5 p.m. streaming on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.